Thanks for being with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to spend the day talking legal issues on the program with our guest, Mike Riley. He represents clients in insurance coverage issues, mediation, and arbitration. He's been with us a number of times over the years. Always great to have him come by. And certainly, if you have questions as we move along, I hope you'll join in. Questions about liability insurance, join the conversation. Number to call is 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Mike Riley, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here in person again. And I love getting questions. Your audience is wonderful, and they always have some great questions for us. So look forward to it.
Let's talk liability insurance. Why do we need it to begin with?
Well, liability insurance protects you if you hit someone else with your car, which is the most common situation. You also have liability coverage under your homeowners, which would protect you, for instance, if you do fail to shovel your sidewalk or do something that's negligent and somebody's injured, or if your dog bites somebody, it would cover you there too. But the most common situation is certainly automobile cases, and that's where most injuries are. You know, the concern, I think, is to make sure you have adequate coverage. Wisconsin used to have 100-300 limits, which meant that you had to carry at least 100 for each person that was injured, up to 300 for anybody injured in one accident. They went back to 2550, which were the old limits, which is 25,000 per person. So if you hit a car and there are a bunch of people, one person can get 25. The whole car is not going to get more than 50. We're living in an age, Larry, where we see emergency room bills between 10 and 25,000 routinely. And particularly if people end up going in and have any kind of a CAT scan or an MRI or any sort of studies, I mean, those bills mount up very quickly. And obviously, if you see serious injuries, you know, cases can run into the hundreds and thousands and even into the millions. Those are very unusual, but they certainly happen. You know, the cases I'm dealing with right now, a number of them, I'd say the average medical bills are probably around $30,000 to $35,000. So if you've got $25,000 in liability coverage, you know, that's just not going to cut it. And under Wisconsin law, your insurance company has to defend you. If somebody sues you, they have an obligation to defend you. And so you don't have to go out and hire your own lawyer. The exception is if the company decides that they want to pay their limits because there's no chance of getting it settled, you know, for anything within their limits, and they just pay the limits, they can walk away. And now you're on your own. You don't have insurance coverage. You don't have a lawyer. And if somebody, people often say, well, I don't have that much to lose. The problem is if somebody takes a judgment against you and dockets that, that can be there for 10, maybe even as long as 20 years. So even if you're in a position today, you just graduated or you're just starting out, and you say, well, gee, I don't really have much for anyone to get. You know, you may at some point, and that may haunt you. And just having a judgment docketed against you is not a good thing. It doesn't do good things for your credit. So having adequate coverage is really important. And the final point I'd make just starting out is this. There's a basic coverage, you know, basic cost for coverage because the company says, well, we've got a risk. You're driving a car. If something happens, we're going to pay. The cost of coverage doesn't go up proportionate to the increase. So if you go from 25 to 100, it doesn't become four times more expensive for liability insurance. It's more expensive, but it's really not dramatically more expensive. So, you know, in terms of liability insurance, I think that's what you need to have in mind. It's important to protect yourself, not just now, but for the future.
And do you, so 100? 1,000?
100, 300, so 100 per person, 300 per accident. I'd say that's pretty standard for most people. It's also usually the level at which you can get an umbrella policy. And umbrella policies are really quite inexpensive. So often, rather than buying, say, 300, 500, or 500,000, or whatever it might be in liability, once you get to a basic level, and again, usually that's 100, 300, you can get an umbrella policy, which is relatively inexpensive. Because again, companies look at that and they say, okay, if you've got 100, the vast majority of accidents aren't going to exceed that. So, you know, the umbrella only kicks in when the injuries are worse than the amount of coverage you have.
Oh, I see.
So the umbrella really is relatively inexpensive because it doesn't pose nearly the same risk of something happening for the insurance company.
Yeah, and it would have to make you feel a whole lot better, more comfortable moving forward, I think.
I think so, too. It's really, you know, having an umbrella, if you have significant assets, if you own a home with equity in your home, you know, any significant assets, it's really important to have an umbrella. We've seen cases, I can't tell you how many times, where people who have very significant assets have completely inadequate liability coverage and don't have an umbrella. I've seen it both in individual sense and in, well, they're individuals, but people who own corporate assets, where you may still be individually liable, it can expose you to just loss of things you've built up through your whole lifetime.
Esty in Madison has a question for you. I think that relates to this. Let's go there. Esty, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you, and thanks for the information already provided. So some month ago, a monster truck, one of these very, very long trucks, drove into my lane. I stopped, but he still hit me. And then he stopped for a moment to shout some abuse at me, and then he fled. I followed him and got the license plate number. Called the police when I got home. They told me that they're not going to do anything about that. No. My car was damaged. I actually got a lawyer, and my insurance found out the company that the guy was working for, but they denied that any of that had happened and refused to pay. I had to pay my deductible to get the car fixed. And now the lawyer is telling me that, again, the company is denying anything. They deny that there was even damage to the car, even though there are photos of the damage. And she doesn't think she can do anything about that. So I'm wondering,
what could she do? Yeah, what other...
How much was... Well, you paid your deductible. Were you injured?
So that's another thing, is that I have some conditions that got worse, but I guess she feels like she can't prove that it had to do with that
with the car, yeah, with the accident.
Well, first of all, I mean, if you have a pre-existing condition, and that's common, we see that probably with the majority of our clients. Neck and back injuries are the most common injuries in a car accident, you know, particularly when you're anybody over 40 has probably had some degree of neck or back issues at some point in their life. And you can collect for the aggravation. They don't have to pay for the condition that existed before, but they are responsible for any aggravation. And that certainly could be pursued. Yeah, the problem, I think, for many lawyers is they look at the case, and depending on the severity of the injury, I mean, from your standpoint, the property damage is minimal because you've just paid your deductible. Your insurance company could pursue it, but they may just decide it's not worth their time to do it. But certainly, you have every legal right to pursue that and to pursue your injury. You could do that not against the insurance. The insurance company limit in small claims is $5,000, which shows how much clout the insurance industry has in the state. The overall limit is $10,000 for most claims that don't involve an injury or insurance company. So, you know, certainly small claims court is an option. It's obviously doesn't give you a whole lot of money. I'm not sure how serious your injuries are, and maybe that's a realistic option. And at the very least, it would force them to respond. I mean, if you bring an action in small claims court, they're going to have to deal with it. They're going to have to hire a lawyer. That's going to cost them money, and they're not going to be eager to do that. Is it the insurance company that your lawyer's dealing with, or is it the trucking company?
And my insurance company did put a lien against them, but I guess, I'm not sure if lien is the right word here, but they did put something legal.
Well, maybe on his driver's license. I don't know if they got something where you can do that. I mean, if you get a judgment, something to be an ability to go after his license. And again, it's always hard to deal with these things. They're complex, and trying to deal with it, over the radio is not the easiest. But I'd at least consider. Ask your lawyer about small claims, because that's something you could pursue on your own. For the lawyer, it's tough, especially if he's doing it hourly, it doesn't make any sense, because you're going to spend more money than you're going to get, likely. And if he's doing it contingent or percentage fee, obviously there's just no margin there for the lawyer. So those are difficult situations.
Good luck, Esty. Something to consider. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Vicki in Mequon, we'll go to you. Hi, Vicki.
Hi there. I have a question regarding your comments earlier about liability insurance, for example, for a dog bite. My son has a dog, but he is a renter. So how much liability does a renter's insurance cover, and what are his options to get liability insurance?
Sure. Homeowners is generally $100,000 liability. You can probably get more, and certainly if you're a homeowner, you should get more than that, because that's not enough. But that's the standard in many policies, if not most. Renter's insurance should cover dog bite. I've had claims against renters, and they've had insurance. And again, I think the normal limit there is 100, but you'd need to check. And what he should do probably is talk to an independent agent. He can certainly call, one of the other companies like American Family, or what he can call companies that write directly. But, I think, or have their own agents. But I think it's in a case like that, I think it's often helpful to talk to an independent insurance agent who has a variety of products, companies that they can recommend. And I'm sure he can get that insurance. The dog bite thing, Larry and I were maybe going to talk about it, so this is a good opportunity.
Let's jump in.
You know, the thing with dog bites is this. Under Wisconsin law, the owner is basically strictly liable for a dog bite. So you don't have to show, if it's a car accident, you have to show the other person's at fault. With a dog bite, you don't have to show any fault. The owner can be doing the right thing, and a child comes up and hugs the dog and gets bit, and the owner's responsible. There are some limitations on that, but not a lot. And so it's really important to have coverage, especially if you have a dog that is nervous, reacts poorly to strangers. And, people so often, when we have dog bite cases, people say, not good old Fido, Rover would never do that. Well, in many circumstances, they wouldn't, but all it takes is one. And usually the bites, children are the worst, because they get bit on the face, which is awful. I had a young woman who literally had her nose bitten off a few years ago, and they were able to replace it. They did a wonderful job, but it was a horrible injury. And, most bites are not that severe. You get a lot of bites on the hand, because people reach out and the dog bites their hand. But even there, I've got a case right now where there was a hand bite, but it ended up getting infected, and the medical bills were about $30,000. So it's absolutely worthwhile to have that coverage. I think for anyone who has a policy, whether it's homeowners or renters, you should check and see what your limits are, and also check to see if there's some restrictions, because many companies will lower the coverage if your dog has a prior incident. So many companies might go from, say, 100 to 25, and that's pretty significant movement. And then if that happens and you're bound on keeping the dog, then you might want to take a look around to see if somebody else will give you fuller coverage. It's one of those things. That the other kind of warning thing to me is rescue dogs. And, before the switchboard is flooded, I'm glad people rescue dogs. I'm a dog person. I grew up with dogs. I like dogs. But I will say that a disproportionate number of the dog bite cases I see are rescue dogs. People often just don't know what they're getting. And I think that if you are going to rescue, then make sure you know what the dog's background is, the history, get that from the operation that's providing the rescue dog. Just make sure you know what you're letting yourself in for, because often rescue dogs are rescue dogs for a reason, and that may well be behavior.
Yeah, there you go, Vicki. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Mike Riley, our guest today. Michael Riley, I'm a Madison attorney and a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm. You can join in with your questions. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Tyler Dinner, our engineer today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at legal issues on the program today, Larry Mueller here with Mike Riley. Mike O'Reilly, a Madison and senior partner in the Axley Law Firm. So great to have him with us today. Again, you can join in 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Betty in Fitchburg, we'll go to you next. Hi, Betty.
Hi. I have a question about my condo association and their lack of performance and transparency. We've had a grounds issue that took 3 or 4 months to settle, one because they didn't know if it was the company that put the roof on or did they have to pay for it. And to this day, I don't know who's paying to fix it. And it just concerns me that the board are not homeowners and they're not treating my condo like a home, rather it's being treated like an apartment building. And that's concerning. What can I do?
Hmm. Well, I'm surprised. Are the board members are not owners in your condo association?
No, they've never owned a home, a single family home.
Oh, I see. So they've just owned condos, but they are owners in your condo association.
That is correct. Yes,
yeah.
That's correct.
I was going to say that would be unusual. Well, this is not, you're not alone. I get these calls periodically. I've got clients for other purposes who have problems with their homeowners. I live in a condo. I actually was on a board in one of the condos we had out in Montana at one time. I'll start out by saying in defense of the boards, and I sometimes disagree with our board, it's a thankless task. And it's one of those things where I can tell you as a lawyer, if our clients ask about being on a board, the first thing we say is don't do it, because you just have to deal with a lot of issues, but you also potentially have liability. I mean, if something goes wrong, the condo boards down in Florida when they had that condo collapse, they got sued along with everyone else. So people who do it need to carry some kind of insurance, not like being on a corporate board, but it is still a problem. You know, I think the first thing you do is you look at your bylaws and you see what they're required to do, and you insist on that they follow the bylaws. And certainly, I can't believe that any bylaw doesn't require that they communicate with you. And again, that's always one of the primary sources of problems, is when people just don't bother to communicate, and they should. And I mean, I'm assuming you went to the board. I'd assume you'd go to the president of the board too, directly, and just say, look, here's the problem. Here's the question. I just need an answer. And you're certainly entitled to that. The problem is, what do you do? If they're not responsive, beyond going, getting other residents involved and maybe getting a petition, which you certainly could do and might put some additional pressure on them. Are you going to bring a lawsuit? I'm not sure what the grounds would be. There might be grounds, but do you really want to spend the money to do that? And that's the problem, because that wouldn't be cheap. So, I think the options really are to deal with it within the association, both directly with the board. And certainly, I'd see if you can't get other homeowners involved, because I'm sure if you're having that problem, other people feel the same way.
Yeah, makes sense. Betty, good luck. Thank you for calling. Kurt, who's on the road, I believe. Kurt, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you guys?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
So I'm a volunteer National Ski Patroller. Perhaps I didn't handle somebody correctly on the hill. I've Would I need additional liability coverage? I've also heard that there's a Good Samaritan Act in the state of Wisconsin that potentially would cover any potential mishandling of an injured skier or snowboarder.
Yeah, I think there is a Good Samaritan Act, and I think it would apply. I'd have to look because clearly it applies to medical personnel, but I suspect it would there. There's also a lot of immunities. There's recreational immunity, which wouldn't cover the ski hill, and it probably wouldn't cover you either under those circumstances. I think the real key is if what you've got is a situation where you're reacting and you're doing what you can, I think it's highly unlikely that you'd be liable unless you either did something intentionally, which clearly you're not going to do, or you did something that was just gross negligence. I mean, if somebody was there and saying, I can't move my arms, and you decided to pick them up by the neck, you know, that would potentially be a problem. But the other thing is the ski area has coverage, and I would assume that they would have coverage that would extend to you as well. Because even though you're a volunteer, you're still working at their ski hill. I know you guys don't get paid, but you're still working at the ski hill. The ski hill's providing equipment for you, I assume, and they're also providing a place for you to work out of, a room for first aid and that kind of thing. So, you know, I would check with the ski hill and say, you know, that's a concern, and do you have coverage for that? Because I think that would be important to establish. Beyond that, I mean, again, you could look at an umbrella policy, which you can have for your homeowners as well. And an umbrella wouldn't cost you a whole lot of money and might give you some additional peace of mind. And, you know, again, it might well be worth that relatively limited cost to do that.
Yeah, makes sense. Kurt, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Sally emailed us to ask where she could find an attorney who specializes in employee and sexual harassment in Wisconsin.
Sure. There are a number of good firms that do a lot of that work. I know there's a couple in Madison that I know of. What I would do, first of all, is I think just as we all do these days, I'd go online and ask, and I think you'll see several firms pop up. There are firms who do a lot of things and also do that, ours being one of them, but there also are firms who really focus their practice on that, and that probably makes sense. The law has become increasingly specialized, and certainly you want a lawyer, if not a law firm, certainly a lawyer whose practice is focused on that, and, you know, who to begin with can give you good advice on whether you've got a claim and whether it's worth, you know, pursuing it, because those things can take a good deal of time and energy. I think a lot of those could be handled on a contingency fee or percentage fee basis. And that's the other thing you want to establish. Is the lawyer willing to do it on a percentage of what we recover? Some of those claims are subject to fee shifting, which simply means that the loser would have to pay. So if you bring a claim against your employer and they resist the claim and refuse to pay, they may have to pay your attorney's fees. And that, again, all of that are things you'd want to discuss with your lawyer and make sure you knew up front how that was going to be handled, what it was going to cost you, and most of all, what are the prospects for success? And, of course, if it is a fee-shifting situation, then it's very important to know the prospects for success. Wisconsin, just while we're on the topic of fee, Wisconsin generally does not fee shift. So usually, like in my cases, my field personal injury, if we recover more than, they don't have to pay the attorney's fees. If we don't recover, they don't have to, don't have to pay theirs either. But for most purposes, you end up having to pay your own fees. But there are exceptions in the fee shifting statutes. And they're, you know, it's always worth knowing whether you fall within one of those.
Good points. Thanks for calling. You can join in too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to John in Mount Horeb next. Hi, John.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate it. The question I have is about thinking about renting our home for a temporary period of time. We own our home. It's a single-family home. We own it outright. And we're planning on spending 3 months in Arizona this winter. And so if possible, we're hoping to rent it to someone else during that period of time. So the question is, do we need any special kind of insurance or coverage on the home since renters would be here for a temporary period of time?
That's a great question. I wish I had an equally great answer. I'm not sure I do. But what I would do is, there again, I talk to your insurance agent. I think it's really important to do that and ask him specifically. Generally speaking, you wouldn't be responsible for anything they did. I mean, if they had a dog, for instance, and the dog bit someone, you wouldn't be liable for that because it's not your dog and you're not harboring it or keeping it. So that should, that kind of thing should, I mean, if they go out and do something silly with their car or do something silly, you know, at the house, they don't shovel the walk and ice builds up and somebody, I don't think you'd have a responsibility for any of that. But I think it's worth taking a look. You know, I know people have had some bad experiences with renters doing things to the home. And again, that's not commonplace. It's not the rule. But you might also ask the agent if there's anything you need to do to ensure that if somebody did do damage, you know, if they leave the water on, burn the house down, and especially in winter, you know, somehow pipe freezes because they don't keep the heat up, you know, are you going to, is that going to affect your homeowner's coverage? That'd be honestly my biggest concern. And I'd make sure you talk to your agent or your company about that.
Yeah, that makes really good sense, John. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Again, you can join in 800-642-1234 or email to ideas at WPR.org. Let's turn to Mark in New Lisbon. Mark, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes.
What's on your mind?
Well, we're in a development, and the developer keeps adding new areas. So really, and he keeps us from having a real HOA for our own individual lake, small lake. And the question becomes, he keeps adding new covenants also that are expensive to us or detrimental to the owners. And are we bound by the new covenants or by what was in place when we bought the house?
I think you'd, I frankly think you'd be bound by what was in place when you bought the house. And I hasten to add, this is not my field particularly, but normally, I mean, those covenants, you buy the home and in part in reliance on those covenants, that those are the rules you have to live by. I don't think he should be able to set new rules after the fact, because, you know, I think you have a strong argument that you relied on that, that that was part of the consideration in purchasing the property. And now he's altering the terms. I don't know that you can do anything about additional development. And we have a place in Montana, and I'll never forget, we owned a condo for a time. And I was told at the time that absolutely would never be anything behind us. Well, you know, there's about 560 homes and condos behind us. And that's one of the things for anyone when you're going into any kind of situation where, you know, you're part of a particular, you're, let's put it this way, where you have real concern about what's going to be there and what surrounds you. The rule is pretty simple to me with developers. If they can build it, they will. You know, if they can develop property at a profit, they're going to do that. And so I think it is really critical at the outset to get a complete understanding of what can happen, or because likely that's what will happen. And you need that in writing, obviously. That has to be there somewhere. But again, I think if you have covenants and those covenants are what you relied on, I don't think he should be able to alter that. Now, there may be something somewhere in the contract with him that says he can, and that's something I just wouldn't know. But if he's arguing that you should be held to additional covenants, I'd ask him to show you where it is in your agreement with him that he's entitled to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes very good sense. It's possible there's something in the fine, the little writing somewhere stuck in there, but maybe not.
Well, you never know. Those darn lawyers get up to that.
All right, Mark, good luck. Thanks for calling. Christina in Glenwood, your turn. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. Hail damage to our roof, May 2022. The adjuster came out, I can't remember, June or July, while I was out of town. We have replacement cost insurance. They offered, or they sent us $12,000 with an estimate of $19,000, a holdback of $1,000, so a total cost of $18,000. I couldn't get anybody to answer my phone at that time since, I mean, there was such severe damage in our area. So this year, I got the names of three reputable company notified the adjuster, his response was that it's been a year, so that they will not exceed what their initial estimate, even though we do have replacement cost. The roofing contractors pointed out that the adjuster didn't even include waste, you know, allow for waste in his estimate. So it's below what it should be. What recourse do I have?
Well, the first thing is, I'd always ask the adjuster, what is it in their policy that allows him to say that? He's saying a year is critical. It may be there's language in the policy that says if you don't do it within a year, then there's a restriction on what you can recover. But he has to show you where in the policy it says that. Has he done that?
No, and actually, when this initially happened and I wasn't getting any responses, I was told that even if it took 2 years, just let them know that I'm looking into this.
Okay. I'd write the adjuster and tell him a couple things. I'd just say, you need to show me, if you're arguing that your policy limits my coverage because it's more than a year, you need to show me the language in the policy that says that. And secondly, I'd go up the line to somebody in the company. Most companies, you know, have customer relations or an ombudsperson or someone who'll deal with complaints. I'd go to them. I have to tell you, and with all due respect for the many good adjusters out there, and I'm sure they're there, and I've dealt with some very good ones, you know, adjusters have a difficult job. You know, they're dealing with stuff. Their job is to save money. Their job is not to please people. There used to be a much greater concern with making sure customers were satisfied. From the adjuster's perspective, that really doesn't seem to be much of a priority in a lot of companies anymore. Things really have changed. But I'd also say that, you know, if you don't get a satisfactory response, you're going to file a complaint with the insurance commissioner's office, and I would do that. And again, I'd talk to somebody up the line at the company, because it may well be that the problem is this individual adjuster either doesn't know his job or is just trying to show, you know, what a crackerjack he is by shorting you. So those would be my first steps. If you have to, you can certainly bring a lawsuit, but that just shouldn't be necessary.
There you go. Good luck, Christina. Thank you. Melissa in Madison, your turn. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. I have a question about getting a will prepared. We have two small children and a house, and I'm just wondering if it makes sense to shop around or if everybody's kind of in the same price range, or I guess any kind of tips starting that process out.
Yeah, I'd always, when we're talking lawyers, I'd pretty much always shop around. I mean, I certainly recommend that for people who have an injury claim. I mean, if you go to the first person, it seems reasonable and you really like them, great. You know, you can call off the search. But I think it always makes sense to talk to more than one person. I think you could certainly call lawyers and at least have them give you an estimate for what the cost of a simple will is. There are a lot of these online kits out there. I don't like them. They're not, you know, they just don't allow you to address any personal issues you might have. And really, a simple will should not be terribly expensive. But, you know, for instance, our firm it's a really fine law firm, but it's a big law firm. You know, is having a will done there going to be a bit more than having it done at a much smaller single person, two or three person firm? Probably. You know, that's just the reality. And it's true of any larger firm. It's just our billing rates tend to be a bit higher. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons for that with volume and everything. But the bottom line is, you know, you want to make sure you've got somebody who knows what they're doing. But the kind of thing you're talking about is not really estate planning, where you need somebody that's maybe quite a bit more sophisticated. It sounds pretty straightforward. And obviously, that's not my field either, so I'm not the best judge. But it certainly doesn't sound like you need something terribly sophisticated. So I talked to two or three lawyers. And incidentally, when the other lady asked about finding a lawyer, the other source that's always worthwhile is Lawyer Referral and Information Service of the State Bar. If you really can't find someone, I think looking on your own is a good idea first. But if you have difficulty, that's certainly a potential resource as well.
Good luck, Melissa, and thank you very much for calling in. You're doing the right thing. You need to get a will.
Yes, absolutely.
And speaking of wills, here's a will in Madison. Hi, Will.
Hey, Will.
Hey.
Where there's a will, there's a way, huh?
That's right. In regards to an umbrella policy, what level of coverage do individuals need? Do we need to cover assets? Do we need to where should we be at on sure. an umbrella policy?
Yeah, and obviously you said assets, and it varies significantly based on your assets. Most umbrellas start at $1 million. I mean, that I don't see them below that very often. And, you know, for somebody with, you know, if modest assets, that's certainly fine. When you get, you know, if you have, I mean, we have a case right now that we're sort of involved in where, you know, clients had very, very large assets and basically had $1 million in coverage, which was just wholly inadequate for, you know, the potential risks they faced. And unfortunately, one of those risks came to pass. And then it's just a difficult situation. I mean, now, you know, everything possible will be done to protect them. But boy, protecting yourself after the fact is really difficult. And so it's awfully important to have a number that at least matches your assets. And, you know, if you want to have a little more than that, and again, going up in coverage just doesn't cost that much. There's a basic cost that's built in because that's the risk cost. And they make judgments about how likely it is they're going to face a claim, period. And then the next judgment is, well, how big could that claim get? And you don't, $1 million claim, you know, may seem routine when you read the papers. It's not. I mean, those are few and far between.
Will, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. And Alicia in Spring Green will give you a chance. Hi, Alicia.
Hi. My brother passed away in 2021, and he didn't leave a will. And so I had to go through probate. And I was struggling with that, and I could never get any answers from Dane County Probate, and I was just having a terrible time. So finally I decided I got to hire a lawyer. So I did, and they gave me some advice, and it ended up to be incorrect. And I paid $600 for that, and they told me specifically that I did not have to do the final accounting, and I went to Dane County Probate, and they said, oh, yes, you do. And so that changed everything because he had a huge estate and I had to do all that.
Mm. So the question is, well, this other attorney, is there a what would you do in this situation?
Well, there are a couple things. And, you know, again, in terms of actual harm, there's not much because you're going to have to do that accounting anyway, one way or another.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to me, the harm is you paid him $600 for bad advice. He should give you back the $600, in my view. You know, I mean, that's pretty simple. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the first thing I do is say, look, you know, this is the advice you gave me. It wasn't correct. I paid you for that. And, you know, my feeling is you should refund the money I paid you. And I mean, based on what you're telling me, I think he should, too. You know, you can always, there is an organization within the Supreme Court, that Office of Lawyer Regulation, OLR, they do the discipline for lawyers. Can you file a complaint? You can. I mean, is that worth filing a complaint? That's probably a matter of how strongly you feel about it. I mean, if the lawyer simply made a mistake, do I think they'll do much about that? Probably not. And do I think he necessarily deserves a complaint? Well, you know, it falls below the standard, obviously. If he was wrong about that, then that was bad advice and that shouldn't happen. But the ultimate question really is, how did it harm you? Probably took some of your time and maybe made you jump through a few more hoops, but I don't think it probably changed the outcome and likely didn't change what you had to do. So in my view, the best thing to do would be to go back to him and say, look, you were mistaken. I paid for that. You really should refund me the money.
There you go, Alicia. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Mike O'Reilly, our guest today. Mike, a senior partner in the Axley Law Firm. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network, taking a look at some legal issues here today. We've started by talking liability insurance and what you need. We've taken some other questions as well with our guest, Michael Riley, senior partner in the Axley Law Firm of Madison. Great to have him back. And we have emails and we have some phone calls. This email from Mandy caught my attention. She fell on the ice in a parking lot of a medical facility went to one of the facility's physicians and was diagnosed with broken ribs. She asked the facility to pay for that visit, and after waiting eight months for a response, the answer came back they wouldn't, because this is Wisconsin where we got snow and ice in the winter, so she just have to be more careful when she walks. Earlier you said that homeowners need insurance to cover anyone who might get injured on a sidewalk. What about the responsibility in this situation?
That's just outrageously stupid. It's hard to believe that a person from a medical facility, I don't know if it was them or their insurance company, may well have been their insurer, because normally they would turn those over. We handle snow and ice claims. Most lawyers do. Are they the easiest claims? No. Are they claims where you can certainly be entitled to compensation? Yes. The real question is, one, did they have notice or knowledge? And that can either be, you know, that they actually knew the condition existed, or it can be that the condition existed for long enough so they should have done something about it. Often the claims are brought, we have one right now, where rather than bringing a claim against the employer, which we can't do under Wisconsin law, we're suing the snow removal company. And all these outfits have snow removal companies. And again, that's a potential source of recovery as well. You know, the question is, they're held to a standard of reasonableness. They don't have to get out with a whisk broom and sweep away every flake. Saying that there's ice in Wisconsin is just, you know, that's meaningless. Yes, of course there can be ice. You can address it by clearing it promptly so you don't build up ice. You can address it by putting salt or sand on the ice. And the real question is, what could or should they have done to do this? And if they had a reasonable opportunity to correct that condition and they didn't do it, then they can certainly be held liable for that. So, you know, I'd go back to them and tell them, you know, your next step is going to be to talk to a lawyer about this. A lawyer, and, you know, you can talk to lawyers. A lot of lawyers will handle those claims. Some of it's a matter of how severe the injury is, so what your damages would be. And some of it's going to be a question of how long had the condition existed. And that's something you may or may not know. But certainly, you know, there are ways of getting at that. If they have a parking lot, they probably have it monitored by cameras, and you may be able to go back and get footage to show how long that condition existed. But the notion that, you know, you can't bring a claim because this is Wisconsin is ridiculous.
Jan in Viroqua, we go to you next. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
I would be very interested in hearing you talk about trusts. I have some family land and a family cabin that I want to leave to the next generation. And I want to protect it in case I ever needed long-term care.
Yeah, and there are, you know, there are trust documents that would do exactly that. I am not a trust and estates guy, so I'm not the right guy to give you any detailed answer. I'd call, you know, a couple firms, a couple lawyers, talk to them about what needs to be done. Those are pretty simple. I mean, you keep a life estate is essentially what happens. So you give them the property, but subject to a life estate. I don't want to go any further than that because I am there are landmines everywhere if I take another step, I think. But that's what you should do. Talk to a lawyer who deals with those. And that should be very straightforward. I mean, that's a simple kind of trust. We did one at one point for part of our property. And, you know, it's nothing any, you know, most, certainly there are a lot of lawyers who specialize in that who are very good, but probably a lot of general practitioners who are capable who could address that as well.
There you go, Jan. Thank you. Hank in Knox, we go to you next. Hi, Hank.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm 65 years old, divorced. I wrote out a simple will or wishes, if you will. I had it notarized and witnessed. Would that be a legal document?
Well, the requirements are you have to have it signed by two witnesses, as I recall. And again, we are now outside my normal territory. But, you know, would it be? Yes, probably it's valid. Would I know that without, you know, having you talk to us or without looking at it myself and then asking one of my partners? No. You could probably call. Certainly could call a lot of lawyers and just ask, and I think they'd answer that question. You know, talk to somebody that does wills. If you want, you can call my brother, Timothy. He's always sending people my way to ask questions. And you know, tell him Mike said he should just answer it for free since, you know, he's always sending people my way. It's Tim Riley. He's in Madison. But that's, you know, it, normally there, you certainly don't have to have a lawyer to do a will. And there's holographic wills that you do by hand. There's all sorts of different things. But you do have to meet the fundamental requirements. And that's, yeah, you know, without knowing a little more, I'm not real comfortable telling you exactly what those are.
All right. There you go, Hank. Thank you. Let's go to Annette in Wausau next. Hi, Annette.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering about a transfer on death as opposed to a will for property to avoid probate. Are you able to tell me anything about that?
Not much, unfortunately. I know it exists, and I know that people, you know, people think it's a great way to do things. I'm not convinced that's true, but again, I'm saying that as essentially somebody who knows probably about an ounce more than you do about that, but not a pound. You know, I just, it really isn't my field. I would not do it without talking to a lawyer who does, you know, wills, who does, you know, estates, because I think there are a lot of pitfalls. I know there's a lot of this stuff is done online, and they get you these documents, and they may or may not be specialized for the specific state you're in, and I'm not convinced that they give you what you need to know whether in your particular situation that's the best solution. So I really wouldn't recommend that without at least talking to a lawyer and getting their view.
Yeah. Deb emailed to ask if homeowners insurance and an umbrella policy would cover an accident injury of a relative painting her house exterior. So she's got a home, she's got a relative, whoever, painting it, but it's a relative, falls or whatever, and is injured.
Well, first of all, I mean, I don't know exactly what the facts are, but it's hard to imagine how you have any liability exposure. I mean, if somebody is painting your house and they fall, unless you did, you provided them with a defective ladder. You certainly aren't automatically responsible for that. And it's not really an employment situation, so you don't have to have workers' compensation coverage. So honestly, I'm not quite sure under what circumstances, if the fall was caused by some negligence on your part, then yeah, the homeowner's coverage would cover that, and so would an umbrella that, you know, that includes the homeowners.
Amber in Cedarburg emailed, her neighbor has a shed on their property, or I guess on Amber's property, and had it for 2 years, and they don't want to start a neighbor fight. Do you have suggestions about what they need to do to ensure that the land remains theirs and that the neighbors must remove the shed if they sell the home, or Amber needs to have it moved?
Yeah, I'd get an agreement with them in writing, and where they agree that this is not it. The concern is adverse possession. If somebody holds property openly and notoriously for a period of time, even though they're encroaching on your land, they might establish a right to possession. Mm-hmm. So you don't want that to happen. 2 years is not enough. I can't remember whether it's 7 or 10. It's a while. But the bottom line is you want to avoid that. And I think the safest way to do that is to get a written agreement with them. It doesn't, you don't need a lawyer to do that, in my view, but I'd want a written document where they acknowledge that they're on your property, that you're allowing them to stay there at sufferance. But, you know, if you ask them to remove it at any time, they will remove it. And that, I think that would take care of it.
Rich in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Rich.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I recently turned 65, and I received from Social Security a couple of letters telling me, one, that there's a company out there that I worked for back in the 80s that has a pension for me, and the second, another company I worked for that they claim on stuff that I have a profit sharing with them with money in each of these things. Now, the letter from Social Security instructed me to write these companies and ask about it, and I have written them. One of them I got a call back from and said, oh, no, that was taken care of years ago. And the second one I've received no response from. So I'm wondering what my next steps are here.
I'm just amazed Social Security is writing you about that. I guess that's a little puzzling. But, you know, I'd reach, I mean, I certainly would reach back out to the company that says it's taken care of and ask for details. So how, when was it taken care of? How was it taken care of? Did you pay money? Who did you pay it to? I mean, they owe you something more than this was taken care of. And the second company, you know, I'd probably follow up with a letter to them. I don't know if that's something I, you know, Larry, that's one where I think consumer protection might do something at the Department of Ag. You know,
Ag Trade and Consumer Protection.
Yeah, I'd reach out to them on the company that isn't responding because that they may be able to do something.
So if you go online to the Wisconsin Department of Ag Trade and Consumer Protection, to their consumer protection divisions, right off the top of my head, I can't remember the phone number or the email, but you can find it online. Go to Consumer Protection. And they will no doubt be able to give you the information you need to file a complaint with them. And then they go ahead and contact the person, too, if they haven't, you know, if you haven't heard from them. If the Consumer Protection contacts them, they will respond. I'm pretty sure of that.
Yeah, I think, the newspapers sometimes will help with some of those things. But with companies like that, you know, if it's a local business, I think that they can be helpful with somebody who's far away, probably much less. So I think consumer protection's the way to go.
Mike Riley, our guest today, senior partner in the Axley Law Firm, and he'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. We've talked a bit about liability and insurance, and certainly if you have questions, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. And you can email us as well at ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a look at the news, and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network, talking legal issues on the show today with Michael Riley, our guest, senior partner in the Axley Law Firm in Madison. He practices on, it's focused on getting fair compensation for people who suffer injuries due to other people's negligence. And he also represents clients in insurance coverage issues, mediation and arbitration. So those are the kinds of things we're zeroing in on with him today. And I hope you'll join in with questions. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Gary wonders if, he called in, wonders, what should he know before he allows someone to hunt on his land? Is he liable for anything?
There's where the recreational immunity statute comes in. And the recreational immunity statute says if you open your land to recreational uses, and it actually, when it was proposed, it was called the Hunters and Berry Pickers Act. So, you know, that's one where you really do fall within the immunity that's conferred by the recreational immunity statute. You shouldn't have any exposure. The only exceptions are, you know, if you can't dig tiger traps on your land, you know, and have somebody fall into them, that would be a problem. But, I mean, unless you do something affirmatively to create a completely unnecessary risk, you essentially have immunity when you let your, when you open up your land. The interesting thing is if you charge people, then you'd lose the immunity. But if you're not charging them, if you're just letting people come in, then you should not have any exposure.
Vivian in Green Bay, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hello, I hope you can answer this. 92-year-old friend took a fall at her home of 40 years. She went to the hospital. They kept her there for to treat dehydration, and she was confused by much of what was going on just because of the injury, no injury, the medications they were administering. So she did eventually recover after some rehab time and went back to her own home. But when she was admitted to the hospital, they invoked the Power of Attorney Acts that were part of her end-of-life three documents. She would like that POA revoked. Is that possible?
Shouldn't be a problem.
Sure. No, there's no problem at all. She just needs to specifically revoke it. You know, the only question I have is exactly how you do it. I mean, I think that what I would do is I would, first of all, I'd send a letter to the people who, you know, hold the power of attorney. Are they her kids or who has the power of attorney?
Niece, nephew.
Yeah. Well, I'd write the niece and nephew and revoke it. The question would be if it's filed anywhere, then I think you'd want to file a document there as well saying that you're revoking the power of attorney. But I definitely would send a letter to those folks immediately revoking it. It wouldn't be a bad idea to speak with somebody who handles those and just ask specifically if something more than that is required. What I'm not sure of is whether some things are filed, wills get filed, not always, but wills often are filed. And then you'd probably want to be sure that wherever the repository was, if it was filed, that you filed something there saying this has been revoked.
But not a problem.
No, there's no reason. It's not permanent. They're revocable, and certainly if she's not happy with that, she should revoke it.
Thanks, Vivian, for calling. Sergeant in Wheaton, Illinois, your turn. Hi, Sergeant.
Hi there. I'm on Bluetooth. I'll just go with my question. And my question is about contempt of court. I'm in Illinois. You guys are in Wisconsin. The Pennsylvania laws are different, and my question is that what will be an outcome? This is in a divorce proceeding.
Go ahead.
Well, there are a couple different kinds of contempt. There's civil contempt and criminal contempt. Civil contempt essentially says a judge has the power to invoke civil contempt if you're not complying with a court order. The judge then can order you to comply. If you don't, then the judge can potentially jail you. And the difficulty with civil contempt, criminal contempt is usually a defined period of time, but civil contempt, essentially they say you hold the keys to the courthouse. All you have to do is comply and then you'll be released. So if you don't comply, potentially you could be held in jail for an extended period of time. The judge could probably impose fines. There are a lot of consequences. You don't want to be in contempt. I mean, you want to, if there's something that, you know, where you feel you can't comply for some reason, you need to go before the judge. You need to lay that out to the judge and explain why you don't believe it's fair that you be held in contempt. Because I will say this, judges come in all stripes and colors, and a lot of them are fine people. Many of them, probably most, are fine people. But some take their prerogatives very, very seriously. Some are a lot more casual about it. If you run into one who is inclined to believe very strongly that, you know, their rules need to be followed, you better follow them because the consequences can be really severe.
Good luck, Sergeant. Thank you for calling. Mike in Stevens Point, on to you. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I have a question. I'm not going to get into a lot of detail, but I've been trying to have the IRS process a return, which for 3 years now, and I've pretty much exhausted all avenues that were available. And at this point, they owe me almost $5,000, and just curious as to where I would look for an attorney to compel them to process or actually sue them for that money that's owed.
That's interesting. I mean, you know, it's within the small claims court jurisdiction in terms of an amount. What I'm not sure about is what you need to do because it's the federal government. You know, with the state, and that's something, somebody called with a question about falling on ice at a medical facility. If it's one of the concerns in Madison is a lot of that is UW, and there are specific rules about suing the UW. There's notice rules, and they are very strictly enforced. So if you have a claim against the UW, you need to look at those rules and the statutes and follow them to the letter. Claims against the city are very different. As long as they have actual notice, you don't really have a problem, although giving notice is fine. But when you have something with the state, so going to the feds, you clearly have been pursuing it. They have notice. They understand what you've done. That one, I maybe go to Lawyer Referral and Information Service to see if they can find someone. who handles. Other than that, I'd go to a tax lawyer. I mean, there are people, again, I'd go online and see who handles tax issues, because anybody who can handle tax issues should be able to handle that. And a lot of times, if you can get to a lawyer, maybe they can decode what's going on and figure out. I mean, it just makes no sense to me that they do they just say they don't owe you the money, or they just ignore you?
They say it's hung up in processing. It's a problem with processing.
Well, that makes no sense at all. I mean, it sounds like you've been. Have you talked to your have you talked to your rep or one of your senators? Because they have if you haven't talked to your representative, you know, your federal representative, you should talk to that person, because they all have, or you know, you can talk to one of our federal senators. They have staffs in their office that deal with issues with the government. And I can tell you, if I worked for a senator for a time, and I can tell you, when a senator calls, or a, you know, member of the House calls, they get a lot more attention than you or I do. And so that might be a good solution here, to at least reach out and try that before you go and hire a lawyer. I'd at least give that a shot, because that might get you the help you need, because they're not disputing they owe you the money, and saying it's process is insane.
Yeah.
Try that.
Try that. Give it a shot, Mike. Thank you very much for calling. Beth in Madison. Your turn. Hi, Beth.
Yeah, hi. I hope I can articulate this well. I have two vehicles, and one's a little truck that I let my friends use, because often people I know need a truck. And I'm wondering, is it enough for me to have my insurance? Are they covered? Would they be covered by my insurance or their own insurance? And what if they don't have their own insurance?
Good questions. First of all, the vehicle insurance is always primary. So if I lend my vehicle to someone, as you're doing, my insurance is going to come in first. And then if they had an accident, there was a bad injury, and that insurance wasn't enough, then their insurance would come in second. So they would, you know, they'd be insured, but their insurance would be secondary. And, you know, if, depending on how often you're doing this and everything, you might think about that when you're getting the limits that you think are appropriate, because that obviously enhances the risk a bit. You're not doing it as a business, it doesn't sound like. You're just doing it as a favor to friends.
Yeah.
And if you're doing that, you shouldn't need any different insurance. Your motor vehicle insurance should cover that.
There you go, Beth. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Listener email to ask you to talk about increases in the cost of insurance for condo associations, especially in Dane County. How can they get the best coverage, insurance for a condo association now? Should they trust their independent agent?
Before that, let me just get back to Beth's question real quick, because one other thing I should have said, Wisconsin does not have owner's liability. So if I lend my vehicle to someone, my insurance company's liable, because but I'm not personally liable for their driving unless they're drunk as lords and I know that, or, you know, they've had 87 speeding tickets and I lend them the car. Basically, the owner is not personally responsible. Condo associations, you know, I've said more than once that I think it's a good idea to go to an independent agent, because they can offer different companies. Different agents offer different companies. So I never think it's a bad idea to shop around. I mean, I think, you know, going to different companies to get a quote for a condo association is a good idea. You know, obviously everyone's insurance has gone up, in part because the cost of buildings have just gone through the roof. And so anytime you have to repair anything, if you have hail damage or anything like that, it gets very expensive very quickly. But, you know, I think it's always worth shopping around to see, because different companies underwrite differently. They look at risk differently, and so they charge differently. And I always think it's funny, you see these ads, and we all see them on TV, where they say people who switched to saved. Well, of course they did, because that's why they switched to begin with. So it's no shock. And it isn't like one company always is going to save you. That's not true. What is true is different companies look at risks differently, and that's why shopping around makes sense.
Linda emailed that her tenant signed an addendum to her rental agreement that the tenant could not use one of the bedrooms. It was used by Linda to store antique furniture. The tenant took all the furniture out, put it in a damp basement and hot attic without Linda's permission. She's wondering what she can do.
Well, I don't know if the question is she liable for damages to that, the tenant? I think she is. I mean, I think that's irresponsible. And actually, if she had renter's insurance, that might well cover that. In terms of, you know, violating the addendum, she can certainly evict her if that's, you know, a critical part of the lease or a significant part of the lease, I would assume. And again, that leases are not really my issue, but I would certainly think that would give you grounds to evict her.
Yeah, it sounds like it to me. Gary in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Gary.
My problem is I've got when I get my W-2 and I file my tax and everything, it's not being transferred over to my Social Security. So the last 3 years, I'm getting actually none of that money in my Social Security. And I'm just wondering who I report it to, because I've been to the the Social Security office to correct it. But I think it's coming from my employer, and I don't know how to stop it, because I brought it up to my employer and they seem to just think it's somebody else's problem.
Well, if they're not transferring it, I mean, that's probably violating federal law, among other things. I mean, there's a wages and hours division that you should talk to. I think, I can't remember if they're state or federal there. I think maybe federal, but there's wages and hours people. You can look them up online, and they, you know, they're the ones who make sure that people are, that that's happening, that if you're being paid, that there's withholding being taken. And I would assume they'd also deal with the transfer to Social Security. And I'd go to your company and say, I mean, are you telling me you're actually doing it and it's somehow getting lost along the way? Because if it's a problem with Social Security, again, I'd probably go to, you know, your member of the House or, you know, your federal senator, and because they really do have a lot more clout with federal agencies than local people do. But and that one, I think also there, maybe consumer protection could deal with that, or at least point you in the right direction. The attorney general's office might get involved in that as well. But I think wages and hours would be my first stop. Well, maybe second stop. First would be to go to your employer and say, explain to me why this is happening.
Yeah.
I mean, they can't just say we think it's someone else. So are you telling me that money is being transferred and somehow just being lost in space? You know, they owe you an answer on that. And but unless you get a satisfactory answer and it gets corrected, I think that's what you need to do.
And the consumer protection number, by the way, I think Clara found that for me, 800-422-7128, 800-422-7128. We've had a lot of high-speed police chases recently, and there have been a number recently that have caused multiple deaths and injuries. What are your thoughts on those chases?
Yeah, I actually...
And who's liable?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, the police may or may not be. It's not, they don't have complete immunity from that. They have discretionary immunity, which is another can of worms entirely. I've actually argued that, and there are limits to it. First of all, I was honestly shocked. I went online to check when I saw there was one in Milwaukee recently, one person killed, 8 people injured, 6 kids in a stolen car, or 7, 2 other people in another car that car collided with. But nationwide, there are 300 people a year killed in police chases, and probably at least a third of those are people who are not involved in the chase at all and just ended up getting, you know, struck during the course of the chase. And, you know, that's probably as many or more as are killed by police shootings that are not justified in any way.
Yeah.
So, and we're all properly concerned about that, and I think maybe we need to be a little more concerned about this. Some departments, a fair number, have policies, but they're deliberately vague, and they're vague because they don't want to create liability. So their office, they can't say, well, your officers didn't follow policy. So they tend to make them very general. Some departments require them to be monitored by a sergeant or a superior officer who is listening in and can say, that's it, cut it off. It's hard because police officers will say, well, gee, if we don't chase everyone, everyone will run. And if, you know, if they know they can just run for a block and then we'll stop, then they'll, you know, why would anyone stop? Well, the truth is most people will anyway. And the other question is, what's the risk you're creating, which is really very great, especially with a chase that lasts more than 30 seconds. You're really creating a tremendous risk of harm to others. You know, what's traffic like at that time of day? What are the streets you're on? And all those things kind of factor into it. The problem is, and said, I did the policy for Madison. I listened into a bunch of chases in order to, when we were drafting, this was way back in law school. And everybody's voices go up about 2 octaves. I mean, the officers do. They just do. And I mean, that's not picking on the officers. It's, you know, it is adrenaline rush and people's judgment. When you get those adrenaline rushes, people's judgment is not as sound as it is when you're just sitting back. And that's why ideally you have somebody monitoring who can say, okay, enough, done. The other question is obviously how severe is, you know, what's the risk you're creating by letting them go? Well, in this case, it's a stolen car. Car's already stolen. Now it's crashed because of the chase. Maybe it would have been anyway. You know, is that worth having a high-speed chase over? Not in my judgment. Now, they also, in the Milwaukee case, said they thought there might have been a robbery. Well, that puts Fiatty up, and you're saying somebody was involved in an armed robbery and maybe, you know, presents a hazard to the public. There isn't a simple answer, but I do think that in general, the risk you're creating in a high-speed chase that goes on for more than a very brief period of time just significantly outweighs the benefit to the public.
Ellen emailed, totally different topic. She has a cottage in central Wisconsin. She rents to friends and family on a casual basis, not through Airbnb, for example. Is standard property insurance adequate for this kind of arrangement? Would the renters themselves have to cover damages caused by injury, or would Ellen be liable as the property owner?
Well, it's again, as the property owner, liability, people think liability is much more widespread than it is. They think the risk is higher than it is. Now, it doesn't mean it can't happen. The bigger concern would be, would you be liable to the renters? If the renter, something happens due to a defect in a step or something, then yeah, you could potentially, you know, have liability to the renters. It's not very likely at all. We rent our property out in Big Sky, Montana. We have, you know, our regular homeowner's policy. I have an umbrella, and I'm satisfied that that provides appropriate protection. I think, the risk there is really pretty marginal, because what's going to happen to somebody, if the renter does something to someone, the renter, you know, punches someone, the renter, you know, pushes somebody down the stairs, or, you know, the renter leaves a roller skate on the stairs and they fall down on that, you're not going to be liable for that. That's not your fault. It's theirs.
So there you are. Well, on that note, Mike, it's always a pleasure. The time flies by every time you're on. I really appreciate your time.
It sure does, Larry, and I love it. One last real quick pitch.
Sure.
We've talked about underinsured motorist coverage a lot. We didn't cover it today. That's coverage that protects you if somebody injures you who doesn't have enough insurance. People, make sure you have that. Make sure you have enough. I can't tell you how many times I've seen cases where if people would have had it, they would have received much more adequate compensation. It's not expensive. So make sure you talk to your agent or your insurance company about it.
Uninsured motorists.
Underinsured.
Underinsured.
Everybody has uninsured if you have liability, but underinsured has to be offered, but it doesn't have to be accepted. So it's important to accept it and get it.
That's a good way to end, Mike. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Larry.
Mike Riley, senior partner in the Axley Law Firm in Madison, our guest. Hopefully we'll be able to get him back and do this all over again. Just a look ahead, Susan Carpenter, the native plant gardening curator at UW-Madison Arboretum, will be along to talk about fall changes in the native garden. That for Garden Talk tomorrow. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.